up, everybody? It's the Orbit Spaceman Show again. And on this great, great episode here, I've got a good man, a funny man himself, on the show.
Hey, I'm Scott Eason. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, no problem.
I'm having a little... I'm not hearing anything but headphones.
Oh, we'll see. So, hopefully now you can hear.
I can hear you. Yeah.
So, man, it's good to have you here on the show, fresh off the Memphis Comedy Festival.
Yeah.
How you enjoying the festival this year?
I love it, man. This Memphis is a great place for comedy, and they do a very good job at the festival. They're... take care of all the comedians, great shows, great venues. I mean, can't ask for much more. I've done a lot of festivals, and this is definitely one of my favorites. I love coming to Memphis. It's great. Yeah, very enjoyable.
Eat some good food so far?
Of course, man. I mean, that's, you know, I mean, when you come to Memphis, you're going to, I mean, I've eaten like shit. I mean, you know, I gained 5 pounds already, but it's been fantastic. Yeah.
Burn that barbecue fat off later.
Oh, dude, yeah. Well, I'm from Alabama, so, I mean, I know about that barbecue. But it's, like, my favorite barbecue place here. Of course, like, Rendezvous is fantastic, and, like, Charlie Burgos is great for supplying the Rendezvous for the comedians, because we get to eat Rendezvous at the festival. But I also really love Central Barbecue. I went to Central for lunch today, and just, like, the smoked wings there are just, like, next level, so... I'm still full as hell.
You're like, I'm ready to take that nap.
Exactly, from what I ate earlier. So, but yeah, I mean, that's one of the things everybody talks about when they come here is like, oh, the food is just, you know, it's like a calling card for the city. But yeah, but the comedy here is great.
Nice.
Great comedians, great people.
Yeah. I'm glad that it's a great place.
Yeah, man. Memphis has got a rep as a good place for comedy, so it's good.
Well, you mentioned you too being from Alabama.
Yeah.
How's comedy? How do you get the differences in comedy from there and here?
I'm from Huntsville, Alabama, and Huntsville is very similar to Memphis in that it's a progressive city. It's different than the rest of the state. It's very forward thinking, a lot of smart people, you know, very nice towns, growing like crazy. People there enjoy art and comedy, and we've built a comedy scene there that's very supportive, full of great audience members that really love it. So it's a great place to do comedy. And the South, period, I think for a long time was an overlooked place for comedians to come to. People are like, why would I want to go to the South? You know, there's not really anything down there. Now there's a lot. So I think... places like Memphis and Huntsville, Nashville, Chattanooga, you know, places like that are really picking up steam because people are realizing that there's hungry comedy fans there that want to see good comedy. They're smart.
But they can be just as funny as a New Yorker or Chicago.
Exactly. That's the whole thing. So it's like, I think now we're getting way more exposure and way more accomplished and established comedians are coming through and touring and doing shows and stuff like that. So it's great for everybody. It's kind of like in the South, like a rising tide floats all boats. You know what I mean? It's like,
right.
You know, it's like it's great if a few cities in the South continue to grow, then more can grow behind it. You know what I mean? It's like,
yeah.
So it's good. It's good. Yeah. Alabama's great. Huntsville's a great place for comedy. So, I enjoy anything here in the South. It's become such a place where you can go to, like, you know, you can get so many good shows in different cities throughout Tennessee, Alabama, Georgia. There's even some good stuff in Mississippi, you know, down into Florida in the Panhandle, Kentucky, you know, all that stuff. So, I mean, there's a lot of good stuff around. And, like, Memphis and Huntsville are kind of, like, centrally located, like, right in the middle. Of all that.
So kind of like, almost kind of like little hubs.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's all comedy is. It's just a series of like hubs. And then in between that, you have the smaller stuff. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's like you got the bigger stuff that is like, that's how, you know, comedians look at it when they map out a tour or they, you know, are routing themselves. They're like, well, I know I want to get from here to here. But what's in between those? And that's when you see a comedian doing a show in these small towns that you're like, oh, interesting. It's because they're trying to move themselves along from one central hub to the next. You know what I mean? So it's like, that's how most places start. It's like a small scene, And then the better it is, and the more it grows, then it can become a hub itself.
Okay. How did you get your start, I guess you're saying, comedy itself?
Well, I started...
You've been doing it for a while now.
I've been doing it for almost 8 years. And, but I didn't start until I was 33. Almost 33. So I'm 40 now. Yeah, I got a very late start. I always wanted to try it, but Huntsville didn't have any comedy at all. There was a lot of comedy at that particular moment, even 8 years ago. There wasn't a tremendous amount of comedy in the South outside of, like, Atlanta. And, of course, there was Zanies in Nashville, and there was a comedy scene there. But even the independent scene there was very small as compared to what it is now. And I'd always talked about it. You know, certain friends were like, yeah, you'd be good at it. But I never had anywhere to go to try it. So I had that ultimate excuse of, like, oh, well, yeah, I'd like to, but I can't. You know? And then my neighborhood bar... where I hung out for a long time, announced that they were having a comedy open mic contest. And then I had no excuse anymore. My friend's like, now you got no excuse, now you gotta try it. So I signed up, and I bombed terribly. Oh, I just ate shit. Like, they cut my mic. It was bad. But it was a radio station that was running the contest, and the guy who was hosting it, the radio DJ, came up to me and he was like, yeah, you weren't funny, but you were good on stage, you know, like, you have a stage presence, you should try again, write more material. And, like, let me say, like, the first thing I ever wrote in comedy, I wrote, like, a 7-minute bit about bestiality, which is not, you know, nobody wants to hear that shit, you know, but at the time, I was like, this is cool. No, it wasn't, it was terrible. But I invited all my friends. I ate shit in front of all my friends. And it was just like, they were just like, rah. I was like, I can't go out like that. I got to try again. And they were doing the contest again the next month. So I signed up to do it again. And my wife, I was married, you know, still am, but, you know, I was already married when I started. My wife was like, don't embarrass yourself. And I was like, nah, I got to do this again.
I got to redeem myself.
So I went back the next month, and I wrote and, you know, prepared and went back, and I won the contest the next month. So that was great. But then when I won, the prize was like $50, but also they were like, the next night you're going to open for... another comedian. I was like, what?
Yeah. No, that's
was,
not part
they
of
were like,
deal.
Do you have 15 minutes? And I was like, oh, yeah, sure. So, like, I just, in 24 hours, I had to write a bunch more material, like, I, you know, do a 15-minute set, like, my third time ever on stage. And it was fine, you know, but it was, after that, I was hooked. But even then, after that, like, oddly enough, after that, the bar turns out didn't have the proper liquor license for live entertainment, so they canceled the rest of the shows.
Oh.
And we went back to no comedy in Huntsville whatsoever. So I was having to drive to, like, Birmingham or Nashville, which is like an hour and a half to 2 hours each way, just to get like 2 to 3 minutes on a mic, and it was really tough. So me and some other guys in Huntsville that I had met that were really interested in comedy kind of got together, and we're like, you know what? I mean, let's just try to build a comedy scene here, you know? I mean, if nobody's going to do it, maybe we can. So we started off, like, crashing music open mics and stuff like that, and, like, signing up, and they'd be like, what instrument do you play? We're like, guitar. And then you get up there, and they're like, God damn it, another comedian. You know? Until they banned us from that. And finally, a bar was like, we'll give you a shot. You can do a comedy open mic. That was our first comedy open mic and stuff like that. And then in July of 2011, a friend of mine, Justin Ledlow, started a show called Epic Comedy Hour, which is at the Low Mill in Huntsville, which is actually the largest independent art center in the country. It's in Huntsville. It's a huge old textile mill that's converted into multi-purpose artist space. It's really cool place. He started a show there in July 2011. I performed on it, and then I shortly after became a producer on the show, and now I've been producing that show for 7.5 years, and we're celebrating our 8-year anniversary in July. It's a great show. We bring in a couple hundred people every month and get comedians from all over the country. But that first show that we did in July of 2011, there was no other comedy in Huntsville. We did that show and 268 people showed up. So it was like, oh, okay, well, there's a market, you know, in Huntsville. Like, people want comedy. So we kept doing that, and the turnouts kept being the same, like, huge. And the biggest crowd we ever had in January of 2012, we got almost 400 people to come out to a local show. You know, it was like, there's a real appetite for comedy here. So that kind of motivated some other people. Then the next thing you know, we got a couple of open mics, and there's another showcase, and like, it's kind of ballooned since then. And then in January of 2017, because of, you know, because we kind of established a scene, the people who own Zany's Comedy Club in Nashville decided to come in and open a comedy club in Huntsville.
Oh, okay.
So now we have a comedy club, which is fantastic. It's my home club called Stand Up Live, and which brings, you know, the best comedians in the country come through there. So now we have a great independent scene. We have a comedy club that we work closely with. It's very supportive of independent comedy. Like, the comedy club is one of our sponsors for my show, Every Comedy Hour, which has been there for almost 8 years. And now I run 3 other shows along with that. So I produce multiple shows. I tour and, you know, all across the country and do stuff. So it started off very simply, and then after all these years, it's kind of gotten to where I'm at now. It's simultaneously, it's a lot of fun, but it's a lot of work.
Yeah.
It's a grind, you know. I mean, I love comedy, and any comedian will tell you, like, you know, they love the art, and it's very fun. But don't be mistaken, it's work.
Oh, yeah. Exactly. Especially when you're starting off.
Yeah.
You know, you got to be at those mics.
Exactly. You know, well, that's the thing is, it really doesn't change the longer you do it.
Right.
Like, certain things, like, it just morphs. It's no longer like, oh, I got to be at every mic. Now it's just like, now you're busy because you're booked, you're traveling, right, you're doing this. So it's like, it's 6 to 1, half dozen the other. It's just a little different. Like, you might feel a little bit less pressure, but at the same time, you still feel the pressure of like, oh, I'm getting booked, but where am I going to be at in 6 months from now?
Right.
Well, how am I progressing? Where am I going?
Right. You know, because it's like being a musician almost too.
Yeah,
it's like
comedy and music are really close. You know, I mean, there's a lot of parallels between the two. The big difference is, like, they always say, like, comedians want to be rock stars, or rock stars want to be comedians, which is true to a certain degree. But it's like, when you're a comedian, it's literally just you.
Yeah.
You're on an island, and you don't have anybody behind you.
Right.
So it's like, if you're in a band and you're a bass player, and during the middle of a song you hit one bad note, nobody will notice.
Right.
The band plays the song.
It's funny you say that, because my very first experience of, like, doing comedy and stuff, because I've been a musician myself for like 16, 17 years.
Yeah.
And I'm a bass player, a saxophone. And so,
yeah.
Going on stage the first time, I told my friends, I was like, oh, this is going to be cool. Like, been on stage plenty of times, not a big issue, whatever. So I get up there, and I'm like, oh, I'm ready. You know what I'm saying? I'm ready to do my thing, ready to drop my joke and shit. And I see it, and I'm like,
and
this mic.
Yeah, like, that's
I
it.
Fuck up.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you're on an island. You don't have any cover. You know?
Right.
Like I said, if that bad note gets lost in the song, but a comedian, it's a bad note. It's just, that's it.
Yeah,
you know, it's just you on the stage. The other thing is, like, if you're a musician, you can write a hit song and it can carry you for 40 years.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, people want to hear that song forever. But, like, when you're a comedian, literally, people be like, oh, I've heard that shit before. You know what I mean? It's like, you continually have to have all, you know, you got to work on your material, you have to have new stuff, you know, stuff like that. So it's like, it's definitely more, I have respect for both art forms, but it's like, yeah, being a comedian is tough, man. Plus, it's like, from the general entertainment community or the arts community, like, people, comedy, especially stand-up comedy, is a lower rung to them.
Yeah.
Because they feel, people say that because it's the lowest barrier to entry. Because you can just go to an open mic and sign up.
Right.
And you don't even have to know how to play an instrument. You don't have to know shit. You just have to be able to talk. As long as you can speak, you can technically do stand-up comedy. Right. That's what
but
people
the thing always people always get messed up is that, like, you can do that, but it's like, you still got to get one person to laugh.
Yes.
You
know what I mean? Yeah, exactly. Like, that's the thing is people just think, like, oh, anybody can do that. No, anybody can't do that. You know what I mean? But that's how people view it. So it's like, you know, I think comedy, obviously I feel it's an art form, and I think a lot of people do too, but I think there's a constant struggle for stand-up, especially, to be included in that pantheon of, like, this is an art, you know what I mean? Like, I like to consider myself, without the cliche bullshit, like, I'm not, like, oh, I'm an artist,
right.
but we are, you yeah. know, like, it is an art form,
right.
you know, that's how I think, which I think lends to the respect of it, you know,
right,
you respect
right.
it.
Because I think two people look at it, and I think some people say, like, oh, it's just stand-up, but it's like, just like there's subgenres to stand-up.
Yeah.
I mean, because you have, like, improv, mm-hmm. you have, like, what you do at the Rose Battle, like
yeah.
improv, probably
yeah.
Storytelling, you know, all mm-hmm. the different types of stuff like
mm-hmm.
that. And so I think people just group it all into one,
yeah.
you know what I'm saying? But if you can look at it besides just the one and the 50 other different things that make up the one, you know
mm-hmm.
I
yeah.
think people have more appreciation.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's definitely... I've noticed in comedy, you have dedicated fans that just love comedy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, in any scene in America, you can talk to somebody who runs independent shows, and they're like, oh, these people come every month or every week, and they watch. And then they don't perform. They have no desire to, but they really appreciate what's happening, you know? And it's like, I think more and more people, when they really go to see comedy, they can get a little bit more respect for what's happening. Especially, I think, independently. Because, like, clubs and everything are great. And, like, when you go to a theater to see, like, you know, if Nate Margatze or John Mulaney was coming to Memphis and they're going to, whatever, is the Orpheum here? Or
yeah.
Yeah, if they go to, like, the Orpheum, like, people are going to pay a lot of money for that. They're going to go, they're going to see it. That's one aspect of comedy.
Right.
Like, going to somewhere like the High Tone to watch a comedy show is a different experience altogether.
Right.
And you really get to see, for lack of a better term, like, grassroots comedy.
It's right,
like,
right.
Comedians that are great, that are on a particular level, but you haven't seen them on TV. You know what I mean?
Right.
And you start to realize, like, it's, yeah, this is, a lot of work goes into this.
Right. Because
yeah,
it's like,
you know what I mean?
You get to, and also another thing, too, is you can, I guess, like you said, like, with the grassroots, it's like, these people have been there writing with pen and paper.
Yeah.
You know, they don't have a team of people. This is
no.
like a late night. I've been up
no,
all night.
Exactly.
You know,
yeah,
whatever.
It's a one-man operation.
Right.
You know, and a lot of comedians, even as big as they get, still operate like that.
Yeah.
But some have teams and, you know, the whole nine. And it's like, I mean, it's no secret. Like, Kevin Hart's a fantastic performer, but he doesn't write all his own material.
Right.
Like, he has a team of writers. There's a lot of great comedians that have had writers, and, you know, and it's like, I get it. I'm not hating on that. It's the same kind of thing, like, if you're a fan of rap music, like, when it came out that, like, Drake doesn't write all his own rhymes, and a lot of people were like, oh, well, he's bullshit because he doesn't write his own rhymes, and I'm like, I get why you feel that way, but at the same time, he's obviously a very talented rapper and entertainer, you know?
Right.
And some people have the skill where they can write it, but they can't rap it.
Right.
And some people can rap, but can't write.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you know what I mean? So it's like, why not peanut butter and jelly, put them together,
right.
and have something that everybody can enjoy?
Right.
You know what I mean? Because it's like, Dr. Dre, who's one of the best producers of all time, but was in NWA, that man never wrote a lyric in his entire life.
Yeah.
He can't write anything.
Man.
He's the beat man. Eazy-E never wrote his own lyrics. Ice Cube wrote everything for NWA. MC Ren wrote everything, you know?
Right.
But nobody ever gives them shit, shit about it.
Right.
You know what I mean?
It was funny, I did a podcast
yeah,
not too long ago, when we were talking about Ice Cube and all that, for instance.
Yeah.
It's like, this dude is like probably one of the best writers of all time.
Yeah.
And one of the lyrics that everybody knows, you know what I'm saying, is an Eazy-E lyric. And it's like,
yeah.
he didn't even write it.
I know.
So,
I know. Exactly. And you know, of course, like, watching Straight Outta Compton, that scene where you see, which, the thing is, you take that movie, like, with a grain of salt, because, of course, it was produced by Ice Cube and Dr.
Yeah.
Dre, and they left some of the nastier parts out. But some of it's true.
Right.
And, like, that whole part where, like, Eazy-E can't rap. I mean, that's totally true. They had
right.
to teach him how to do it, but like he was the actual dope boy. He was the one that had the real rep.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
The rest of them were just fucking, you know, kids from the projects. They weren't criminals. They weren't drug dealers.
Right. he was the poet.
Exactly. Exactly. There's so many different ways to skin a cat.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's just I like to see all parts of it represented if possible, so
right.
people know that it's multifaceted. It's literally not just somebody getting up there and talking about their dick on stage.
Right,
you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, there's a lot more to it, but it's like, especially in certain places in the country, like, it's definitely more, they haven't been exposed to it. Like, I've been to cities where they're like, oh yeah, this is the first comedy show we've had here, and like, people, like, come out because they've never seen it before, they want to understand it, but then they don't know how to act. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, because there's certain etiquette to comedy. Yeah. It's like, you know, you're supposed to be quiet and listen, but they've never seen it, so they think they can just holler out or interject themselves into it, you know, whatever. But, I mean, I enjoy bringing comedy to people who necessarily wouldn't see it any other way. It's a trip.
So, like, was saying that, too, since you've been doing stand-up for 8 years, I'm pretty sure you've ran into your fair share of, like, hecklers.
Oh, yeah.
And shit like that. So how do you handle hecklers?
It's a slippery slope, man. Like, fortunately, and most comics will tell you this, like, there's this whole subset on the internet of, like, comedian destroys heckler. You know, like, if you YouTube, trust me, just if you're listening to this, YouTube comedian destroys heckler, and you'll see thousands of videos. It's because it's become like this nasty little subgenre. But in actuality, most comedians don't really have to deal with hecklers very often. And no comedian ever wants to be heckled. No comedian's out there like, hell yeah, somebody says some shit. You know what I mean? Like, I can't wait to rip into their ass. Like, no comedian wants that. But when it happens, you have to kind of assess the situation. Like, is that person, is it malicious? Are they maliciously trying to heckle you? Are they like, fuck you? Or, you know, or are they just like, oh, hey, that happened to me one time. You know, because some people, they just either, that's how they're literally expressing joy. That's how they're agreeing with you. They think they're helping you, you know. So it's like, if that happens, of course, you might ignore it the first time. If it happens again, then you have to address it, you know. And then once you try to address it in a funny way that's not going to hurt anybody's feelings, you know. Maybe make a little crack at them, but something that they can maybe laugh at too. Before you take it into the level of, like, where some people have seen where you're, like, going in on a heckler. And then finally, if you lose your cool, they lose their cool, and then somebody gets kicked out.
Right.
You know what I mean? There's, like, there's levels to it.
Right.
So it's like, you can't really assign a, what's that, like, a pre-recorded response in your mind.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Because I guess at the moment, it's almost like improv.
I've seen it a lot. Like, a drunk woman in the crowd. I've seen this happen many times. Drunk woman in the crowd. Yells out at the comedian. Comedian ignores it, maybe makes a little crack about it. Drunk woman yells out again. Comedian's like, hey, and then maybe cracks on her again, right? Audience laughs. Third time, comedian starts to get mad. Now the comedian says something hurtful. And people are like, ooh! You know, like, you know what I mean? And the woman's like, that, of course, now this drunk woman, now her pride's hurt.
Right.
So now she wants to go in again. Now she goes again, and the next thing you know, the comedian calls her a bitch, or the C word, or something, you know what I mean?
Right,
like, and the comedian, understandably, is angry.
Right, because now it's three times.
But now, the comedian is the bully.
Right.
Now the tables have turned.
Right.
This woman was disrupting the show, and was obviously in the wrong. But now, you've crossed that bridge, and now the people in the audience are like, you're a bully with a microphone.
Yeah.
You know, now you're picking on this poor woman. You said this, and now that woman has all the power.
Right.
You know what I mean? Or the man, or whoever it is. It's a slippery slope. You know, it's a very slippery slope. That's why, like, when you're in a... If you're in a comedy club and someone does that shit to you, security will just come remove them. Like, you don't even have to do any work in that respect.
Right.
Certain headliners, I mean, headliners I've worked with, they'll have code words if they want somebody kicked out. So if somebody they interact with is talking shit or something happens, and the headliner's like, I sure would like a glass of water, then yeah. the security's going to come and be like, you need to come with us, and, like, remove the person from the crowd. Yeah. But, like, for somebody like me, like, if I'm in Tulsa, Oklahoma, doing a show, there's no security, yeah. you know? And some shit like that happens, then I have to be very mindful of how I'm going to handle this interaction. Yeah. And hopefully somebody that runs the show, a producer, right. will try to remedy the situation too, because the last thing any comedian wants to do, no matter what they say, nobody wants to go and be like, you fucking bitch, and like lose their shit, because right. then the audience is like, oh my god, right. like it's like right. it turns combative and mean, and right. nobody likes it,
and then you know the crowd either turns against you
precisely,
and then like right. or you exactly. forget all of your material yes. and all that
yeah and well. Then you have the hecklers, you have people that will yell out that when you address them, they're like, oh shit, I don't want to be singled out, so they shut up. You know what I mean? Some people will say something like, hey, who said that? Or like, you, what, and they're like, because they realize like, oh yeah, shit, like, I don't yeah. want you to, you yeah. know, don't talk to me. But then you have people who do it and they're like, come on, say something. Like, yeah, come on. You know, they're right. they're baiting the comedian
right, right.
to get them to say something.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's like, so that's the thing is, there's not just one type of heckler. There's many different types. And there's many different ways to handle it, but it's like you have to balance that where the audience isn't going to think you're a bully
right.
by doing it.
right.
You know what I mean? Which is a complicated answer to a simple question.
well, no,
but,
I mean,
but it's true.
But
there's,
that makes
there's
sense.
Nuances
that makes
to this sense. Shit. You know yeah. what I mean? This is chess. It ain't checkers.
yeah.
yeah.
I definitely get what you mean.
Yeah, man. You got to, I mean, I've seen it go bad from Jump Street. I've seen beautiful heckler interactions. I've seen it where a heckler says something and then the comedian riffs on it and it's the funniest part of the show. But that doesn't mean it's right.
Right, right,
do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You'll have that's the heckler that comes up to you after the show and they're like, you're welcome, bro.
Yeah.
You're welcome. You're like, no, you fucked up.
Yeah.
It was wrong what you did.
Yeah, right.
You should know it was wrong. I just recovered from what you did.
Right. But then the crowd is like, yeah. that was the best part yeah, of your hey, show.
Precisely. Right. So it's like, yeah. It's a weird thing. Which, like I said, luckily is really more the exception and not the rule.
Right.
More the exception of the rule. You don't, luckily, because if it was just like every day you're out here dealing with hecklers, people are like, I fucking quit.
yeah.
It's ridiculous.
it's like every show yeah. day, you look like
well, exactly. Fucking, it's true. I mean, it's true, but people don't think about it that way. It's like, if you're heckling me, and like, it is cliche, but it's so true. If you're fucking heckling me, and I'm like, where do you work? And they're like, Domino's. That'd be like me coming to Domino's. Be like, make that pizza, bitch boy.
Yeah,
come
right.
on, bitch boy, make that pizza.
Mix that sauce.
you know what I mean? They'd be like, shut up. Stop. but they don't ever think about it.
right.
They don't think about it.
Right. So, and then the funny thing is, too, is that I explained that once before to a friend of mine who's a musician, whatever. And because I was like, musicians get heckled, but it's like, it's such a rare, rare thing
yeah.
that it happens. Even when you're, even in the grassroots era and you're starting mm-hmm. off, but like, it's a rare thing that it happens. You may get that one drunk guy, that chick, who's like, you guys suck. you know what I mean?
Yeah,
but
yeah.
like, that's about it. And so it's like, the differences in, like, how we were talking about music and comic stuff earlier, that's a huge one in itself, too. Like you
yeah.
said, with just being the mic, you have to deal
yeah.
with the whole crowd.
Well, that's the whole thing. Music does not have the expectation that the crowd will be silent.
Right.
Comedy has the expectation that you are going to shut your mouth. and that's it.
Yeah.
Like, music is, like, here, you can be in a bar, a band can be playing, you can be having a conversation with somebody at your table, and still enjoy the music.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Like, it's in the background, you're like, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, and you're, like, listening, and you like it, and you're still having your conversation, everybody's happy. You cannot be having the full conversation
right.
and listen to a joke
right.
and have it be okay.
Right.
You know, that's the whole thing. It's like, music has that background effect, that it can just be happening, and you can soak it in and enjoy it, but you can still do other things. Comedy is literally a laser, it's supposed to be a laser focus event. You're
right.
sitting in your chair yeah. looking at me, ha ha ha, laughing at what I'm saying. you know what I mean?
Okay, so that's, I guess, leads to one of my other questions. Is with comedy nowadays, with the, you know, the evolution of entertainment and everything like that, you have a lot of comics who just, instead of like actually doing say, like, a video special or whatever, they just record just the album itself.
Yeah.
And so, like, what do you see on that? Because, like, I'm one of those type of people, I guess, when I think of a comedian special
mm-hmm.
or them putting something out, I think I'm visually seeing it, you know? I guess because, one, you're used to seeing whatever emotions or facial emotions or, you know, whatever they're doing on stage.
Uh-huh.
But it's like listening to it on the album, you're almost like, ah, it's funny, but I wonder what was happening like in person.
There's, I don't know. I think that's different from person to person, because some people can, like myself, because I like comedy, I can listen to a comedy album and enjoy it fully,
right,
just like I'm there. Some people can't. Some people can't. They're like, eh. And then you have that next level where they're like, oh, if I'm watching them on TV, I can laugh and I can enjoy it. But in action, and then you have like the third tier, which is like, some people are like, there's no substitute for live comedy. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
Which there really isn't. That's the whole thing. It's like, live is the best way to,
right,
to take
right.
this art form in. Yeah. It's like, albums are great, specials are great, but I guarantee, like, if you were watching, like, for example, of Nate Bargatze has The Tennessee Kid out on Netflix, which is a brilliant special.
Oh, yeah.
It's
yeah.
very, very funny.
He's a hilarious comedy.
But if you're in that crowd watching that night, you're actually there. It was 10 times funnier than it was sitting on your couch.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? 10 times funnier. But even when you're on your couch, you can laugh and enjoy it. And then you kind of take a step back, and now listening to it on a CD in your car, it's still funny.
Yeah.
But maybe it's not as funny as watching it on TV.
Right.
It's definitely not as funny as being
right,
there.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Right.
So it's like there's tiers.
Yeah.
So that's the way I look at it. It's like, and plus, like, from the comedian aspect of it, the first thing that most comedians strive to do, you know, you have several benchmarks in your comedy career. One of them is recording an album. The other is TV appearance, you know. And then finally, you know, the holy grail for most comedians is 1 hour special, which is now on Netflix or Comedy Central or if you're huge HBO Showtime, you know, or something like that. But, like, the first thing that most comedians strive to do is record an album,
right.
You know, because it's number one, it's many sides to it. One is it allows you to basically take the material you've been working on, put it on wax, and then move on to something new,
right.
You know, much like music. Like, you're recording a music album, and you're like, okay, I've got my 10 tracks, and you put my 10 tracks down. Then when you're ready, you go back to the studio and you record another album with 10 brand new tracks.
Right.
Same thing with comedy. Once you have the material prepped, you lay it down and then you move on to the creation of the next hour of material. Right? Also, so you can have merchandise, so you can have something to sell when you're on the road. Because, you know, I mean, merchandise plays a big part in comedy. It's how a lot of comics make money on the side. So it's like you do a show somewhere, and people are like, I really liked you. You're like, great. Well, I have a CD. You give them a download card, whatever. That way they can enjoy it, but also puts a little bit of money in your pocket. But maybe through word of mouth, they share it with friends, your fan base grows, so on and so forth. Also, audio recordings are huge now because you have the streaming networks. So you have Pandora, you have Spotify, you have SiriusXM. So those are all income streams for comedians, because once you have recorded material, then you can submit it to those streaming services, and then you get paid based on the number of streams. So on Pandora and Spotify, you know, if you have a whole album, somebody can go in there and stream your album, and you're going to get, you know, a few cents for every stream. So if you get to the point where you have a bit of a fan base and you can grow how many people listen to your streams, you can bring in a few $100 a month. You know, some of the bigger comedians, like, you know, Bill Burr, you know, stuff like that, between SiriusXM, Pandora, Spotify, he's making thousands of dollars a month. Like, major money.
Yeah, he's got a podcast.
Yeah, major money. And that's easy because that's basically money on top of what he's already getting from the album sales and from the people coming to the tour and paying for tickets. You know what I mean? So it's like it supplements your income, but it also allows you to get out to a much wider audience via those platforms. Because on SiriusXM, you listen to Comedy Central Radio or Raw Dog, they just put you in the rotation. People hear you, and they're like, hey, that's interesting, and then maybe they go buy your album. Or on Pandora or Spotify.
I'm waiting for the next one.
Exactly. Pandora or Spotify, you get put into a comedy mix where they just play different comedians and people hear you, or somebody chooses to go stream your whole album. You know what I mean? So it's like that's the root of what we're all working on. It's like we all want that, you know what I mean, to start with. And then you parlay that into a Comedy Central half hour or a late night television show appearance or something like that, and then that's another stepping stone to the next thing, and then the next thing, and then you get the 1 hour special on Netflix that you get paid $1 billion for, you know what I mean, or whatever. So it's like, it's all stepping stones. Like, comedy is a ladder that never ends. That's the thing, is there's no roof.
Right.
Like, even, comedy is a weird thing in that, like, at any given time, there's only room at the top for maybe 4 to 5 comedians to be the biggest comics in the world.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
At one point, the biggest comedian in the world was Louis C.K.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that's not the case anymore. Kevin Hart's always up there.
Yeah.
Amy Schumer's been up there. Dave Chappelle, Bill Burr. And then now you got guys that are huge coming up on the rise, like Burt Kreischer, Tom Segura, you know, Dave Marcazzi, Mulaney's a huge comedian. But it's like these circles get smaller and smaller and smaller as you get to the top, right? But there's a lot of stuff happening for these mid to upper tier comedians that are below them. So it's like somebody, I know comedians that have been on The Tonight Show, have been on Jimmy Kimmel, have been on Netflix.
I was going to say, I was
been on all
that
kinds
was one
of things.
Of my questions.
And they're still grinding. They're
right.
still out here grinding because it's never ending. Just because you get that one thing, if you get to be on Jimmy Kimmel or if you get to be on The Tonight Show, it's not like, well, my work's done. I'm just famous now.
Right.
And, like, that's it. Like, right. Ooh, I made it. No.
And the funny thing is,
one little itty bitty thing you have to keep. You got to keep moving.
Right. Because it's like, and I was thought about that too, because it's like, I guess you think about it, it's like if you did The Tonight Show one night, but it's like, well, I did The Tonight Show, well, that week, Jimmy Kimmel was bigger than The Tonight Show. So it's like, I got to go do the next one then, you know?
Yeah. One of the biggest honors for comedians is to get to do a late night show. But, like, again, civilians, and that's what comedians call non-comedy focused civilians. You know, they think, oh man, I saw you on The Tonight Show, man. You must be huge. You hit it big. It's like, no. No. Because when you do The Tonight Show, you get paid, give or take, about $1,000. Which is like, wow, that's $1,000. You know what I mean? In the grand scheme of things, $1,000 is a lot of money.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? It's not. You know, and yeah, they fly you and, like, you know, you get the treatment and it's like your moment where you're like, wow, this is amazing. But all the comics I know, and, you know, Lord willing, knock on wood, you know, hopefully that's one of my goals, is to get there one day, is to do a late night set. But they use that as a stepping stone to get the next thing. You know what I mean?
Right.
Now that's their credit. Now that helps them. Now, oh, I can get booked on this show that I couldn't get booked on before because now I have a TV
right.
credit.
It's like, this is my legit token. You know what I'm saying? Like,
precisely. That's your currency now to get you into the next door. But once you're in that next door, now you got to do more shit to get the next thing, to get through the next door, to get through the next door, you know what I mean?
Right.
It's never ending. Never ending. So it's like, and I mean, it's daunting and it's frustrating, but it's also exhilarating at the same time. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, to just to try.
It kind of, I guess you say, keep you young. Like,
yeah.
Because you're constantly on the move.
Well, it's like, put it this way. Any comic, I'd probably say 95% of comedians that you see that have been doing it for a few years, regardless of their level of success. And don't get me wrong, you do have some jaded comics and shit like that out there, but most of us, even the ones that have achieved fame, they just love doing comedy.
Yeah.
You have to have the love for it.
Right. Because
if you don't have the love for it, it doesn't matter. Like, honestly, if you don't love comedy, everything else, it's not worth it. Everything you have to do it, it's not worth it.
Right.
If you don't truly love it.
Right.
And that's even true if you're fucking performing at Radio City Music Hall in New York and this and that. It's like, you still gotta love it.
Yeah, right.
To want to do it.
Yeah.
So it's like, that's kind of what keeps us all together. It's like, what's in the community is like the love of doing comedy. You know, it's like, and it's a cliche, but it's true. Like, I would do it for free.
Yeah.
You know, I'm fortunate enough to get paid to do it, but I would do it for free just because I love it. And at this point, it's become such a part of my identity. If you took it away from me, it would be like you took heroin away from a heroin addict. Like, I'd go into withdrawals. I wouldn't know what to do because my entire identity has been morphed around being a comic for the past almost 8 years.
Yeah.
But that's just who I am now. And, I mean, that's true for every comedian. If you do it for a certain length of time, I think, and it's different for everybody. It could be you do it for a year and you realize. It could be you're 5 years in and you realize, holy shit, this is like my entire, for lack of a better word, this is my entire personality.
Right.
Is that I'm a comedian. I don't know who I am without comedy in it. And that's good and bad. Because you don't want to get completely lost in it, but it's also unavoidable that it's become a, that it's going to become a major part of who you are. And the people that you love and your friends and the people around you have to understand that, because it's inevitable when you're a comic, you're going to lose friends. You could ruin relationships, because there's going to come that time in your life where comedy is literally going to come before anything else. Doesn't matter who it is. But you're going to have to tell your girlfriend, like, look, I love you, but this is my priority right now. And they're either going to understand that, or they're not going to understand.
Because at the end of the day, too, it comes down to, one, you've got being on that grind. It's not only writing to be on stage and everything. You're on that grind of getting your shows, getting yourself, basically getting your face seen. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
A lot of, too. And it's a lot of late nights.
It's a lot of late nights.
I help a lot of travel.
Yeah. I help teach a comedy class at Stand Up Live at Huntsville, the comedy club. And it's like, I never took a class, and I know most comedians didn't. And it's kind of funny. There's a people, like, comedy classes get flack, but there's different levels of comedy classes. Like, the comedy class that we put on, and I know a lot of other very successful comedy classes, like in Atlanta and a few other places, that you're not teaching somebody to be funny, because that can't be taught.
Yeah.
We're not writing jokes for you. But we're literally trying to prepare you for what it's like to be a comedian or to try. And that starts with literally the simplest is like, here's what you do when you get on stage as far as like, here's how you should hold the microphone. Because trust me, there's a wrong way to hold a microphone. Here's how you hold the microphone. Here's, move the mic stand to the back of the stage. Here's how you introduce yourself. Here's how you close it. You know what I mean? Like the intangibles. Like we teach all that stuff. But it's so funny when people ask the question and we honestly answer. And it's like, okay, well, you know, the open mics are at this time and they start. This one starts at 10 p.m. People are like, oh my God, 10 p.m. I got to go to work in the morning. I'm like, no shit, everybody's got to go to work.
Yeah, right.
But you know, like that, it's like, if you're going to do this, this is part of what you do.
Right.
And that, I'm talking 50%. People are like, no.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't know this was going to be work.
Right.
It's like, what did you think?
Right.
You know, like, some people literally just come in and think they're just going to take this class, and then all of a sudden, well, I'm getting booked at the club, and I'm headlining. It's like, hell no.
Right.
And like, you start bottom. Like everybody else. But it's like, they're not, but that's the thing, is some people are literally not willing to do that. So, I mean, that thins the herd very quickly.
Right.
Because it's like, you'll see people at an open mic, and you're like, all right, this is Joe's first time, and he comes up, and maybe he gets some laughs, and he has fun, and he's like, yeah, man, yeah, this is how I'm up to beat, I'm up to comedy, yeah. And then you see him for like 2 weeks,
yeah.
And then you never see him again, because he's like, oh, I didn't know you had to go, like, every week,
yeah.
I didn't know you had to
I didn't know it was practice,
every
like,
night,
like,
I just thought, like, I thought I was going to get signed that first night, you know, it's like, that's literally how delusional some people are about it, but it's like with anything that's worth doing, like any art form, it's a practice, man. I mean, you've got to grind. It's like, I keep a show journal. I advise this for any comedian, and this is not a brag, because I know comedians that have put me to shame, but I performed 302 times last year. Yeah. I got on stage 302 times.
That's a lot.
It is a lot. But it's also like with comedy, sometimes it's very, in certain cities, it's easy to get up 4 or 5 times in a night. So those numbers aren't, you know, like you know, I didn't perform 302 days straight.
Right.
And like that. It's just, it's maximizing how much stage time I can absolutely get. You know what I mean? So that, but I also, this is what I want to do, so I take it very seriously. But it's like, in my personal opinion, if you want to be a hobbyist and you want to come out and you do comedy once a week, that's fine. It's just if your goals are different. But you can't say, I want to be a comedian and then perform twice a month.
Right.
Because that's not what it means.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's like,
that's basically, kind of like the music thing. It's kind of like, oh, I want to be in a band, but we only play once a month.
Precisely. So yeah, that's why I mentioned like tracking how many times you perform. It's like, I use that as a yardstick to measure you know, am I maximizing? What am I doing? You know what I mean? It's like, how much am I practicing? And it's all very valuable information to me.
And it's making sure that you're getting your time
worth. Precisely. Such, man, I know comedians that literally go as far as create a spreadsheet, and every time they perform, they go on the spreadsheet, they put the date, they put the time, how many minutes they did, what was the name of the show, where was it at, who all was on the show, how many people were in the audience, and then they list their set list, and then they can go back and look at any given night and know, I did these jokes for these people in this town at this time. And I don't go that far. You know what I mean? But that's how analytical comedians can be. And you have to have a bit of an analytical mind, because there's a tremendous amount of preparation, organization, and execution when it comes to being a comic.
Right.
So it's like when you... Everything I just explained, when you tell a person that just came into a class because they want to tell a dick joke, they're like, oh, shit.
Yeah, like,
that sounds like so much. And it's like, well, it is. But
is this
it's also
real school?
Like, it's a labor of love. You know what I mean? It's like, we love to do it. So I don't view it as work. Sometimes it is work.
Yeah.
But overall, like, the work part is getting in my car and driving 5 hours to do a show. And everything up into the point that I grab the microphone on stage and tell my jokes, that part's not work, but everything else around it is work. The driving, the waiting, the this, the that, the sleeping on the floor, the bullshit that you put up with is all just leading you to that moment where you grab the mic, and that's when you're truly in the moment.
Right.
You know what I mean? But it's like, there's so much that goes into it. So it's like, I think, I want people to know that, you know what I mean? I don't want people just to think, like, some people are so, it's so adorable. They think, like, I've literally heard people say this, they think comedians, when they're up there, they're like, oh, they're just coming up with that stuff off the top of their head while you're up there.
Right.
You know what I mean? They don't think that you've sat down, that you've written.
Right.
They don't know that
you've
practiced
it. You said those jokes 50 times.
They don't know that you've eaten shit when you were coming up with that idea.
Right.
You know what I mean? They don't know that you've changed it 100 times.
Right.
You know what I mean? They just think, oh, isn't that cute? He just came up with that while he's up there. You know what I mean? So it's like, yeah, I just want, and that the funny thing is, comedians, you put in all this work to make it look like you put in no work on stage.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The best comedians do look like they're coming up with it off the top of their head, because they're so fluid and natural that people just believe that this person's just naturally funny, that this is just happening right before my eyes.
Right.
When so much fucking work went on the back.
Yeah, right.
You know what I mean?
Right. And it's like, I mean, I think too, a lot of people forget that it's like, even when you have big artists and stuff like that, there's like, a lot of them still do those little small clubs here.
Oh, they do. Yeah.
It's like when they're working on those new material or whatever, how many times they've probably eaten shit on the way to get that one joke.
I won't name names. I've seen famous comedians eat shit.
Yeah.
It happens. With famous comedians, it's funny. The fame is a weird thing, especially in comedy. I mean, I have no fame. I come from a position of zero fame. But watching famous people, especially, like, even if you're real famous, if you come out on stage, people will give you about 10 minutes where you can just go up there and be like, fart, 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 fart. And they're like, ah, hilarious. You know, it doesn't matter what you do. But after 10 minutes, they start being like, all right, now you got to make us laugh.
Right.
Now you have to, you know what I mean? So it's, yeah, people will only, fame will carry you so far.
Right.
Before you have to deliver the goods. Do you know what I mean? There's that weird effect, but it's also, it's so strange that, like, when you reach a particular point in comedy, like Aziz Ansari, or, you know, a lot of other comedians, are just using Aziz as an example. Like, when he wants to prepare new material, he's not going to open mics. You know? He'll go to, like, he lives in L.A. or something like that. He'll go to the Comedy Store, do some sets and like that. But he'll literally set up a club tour to work out material. So that means you're paying $35 a ticket to watch him do what we do at open mics.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Right.
It's like, that's true. Like, they go up there and they're like, yeah, I got some ideas. Like, and they just go up there and they riff it out, and if it doesn't work, they're like, okay, notes, that didn't work,
right.
I need to fix that. While you're paying $35 ticket to see that. You know what I mean? Like, before Chris Rock recorded his last Netflix special. He did 10 shows at Zany's in Nashville. He did 10 shows in, I think it was 4 or 5 days. I think a couple days he did 3 shows, maybe one. But anyway, 10 shows in like 4 to 5 days, where he went up there with raw material and then hammered it out in front of people that paid $50 a pop. See, here's the thing. Some of it they loved, some of it maybe didn't get a lot of laughs, but it's Chris Rock, so, right. I mean, he gets the respect, he gets the latitude to be able to do that, you know what I mean? So it's just like when you see that, it's the same thing, just on a different scale. It just so happens that now you're so big, you get paid.
Right,
to work out on material.
Your,
do you know what I mean?
You're getting paid to do it.
Yeah, but the thing is, the underlying message there is he still has to work on material to get it ready before he puts it on Netflix.
Right.
Nobody's famous enough where they can be like, oh, I haven't done this in front of any audiences at all, but I'm going to record it for Netflix.
Right. This is like
that doesn't happen.
I was explaining to someone, I was like, that's just like if fucking Eddie Murphy. I was like, if he came out with a special that was tomorrow on Netflix or HBO or whatever, I'm pretty sure that this dude has been working on this for years at a time. He's going to come out and
before
be like,
before you saw a special of Eddie Murphy's on Netflix. For months before that, you'd hear, oh shit, Eddie Murphy performed comedy at the Comedy Store in LA last night.
Yeah.
You'd be like, oh really? He's back on stage? And the next thing you know, you're like, oh, Eddie Murphy was in New York last night. Eddie Murphy was in Chicago. You're like, oh shit, he's getting ready.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
You can tell.
Right.
You can see when these comics are, like, Chris Rock's not in clubs and shit right now.
Yeah.
But the next thing you know, if you hear Chris Rock doing club dates everywhere, you're like, oh shit, he's about to drop another special.
right.
You know, the writing's on the wall, because that's what has to happen. You have to hammer the shit out in front of people, because at the end of the day, as a comedian, you're just a servant to the people.
Right.
You know, it doesn't matter.
Jester.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, what you say can be funny, but if people have to laugh at it.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's no way to test if it's going to make people laugh unless you tell it to people and see if they laugh.
Right.
There's literally zero substitute for what we do. You know, I mean, like as a comic, Chris Rock gets on a stage in a theater and sells out 10,000 seats to watch him.
Right.
He had to do those same jokes in front of 250 people in a small club to make sure that they passed the litmus test to do in front of those 10,000 people.
Right.
Then he did them in front of those 10,000 people and they laughed, so he could then put it on Netflix so millions of people
see it. Right.
Do you see the steps?
Yeah.
You know, as it goes up. It's wild, but that's literally, there's no substitute for that comedy. So from your average open micer that goes to open mics 3 or 4 days a week, does some showcases, is working, honestly, the process is the same as Dave Chappelle, as Chris Rock. We're all in the same boat. Yeah, they're way more famous, and they might be naturally funnier than you, but you're still doing the same thing.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right. And they're just still doing it.
Paying
to take those steps.
It's still the same thing.
Because you think, exactly, because they, at one point in time, came from the grind of not getting paid.
Nobody just came up and was like, oh, I'm famous now.
Right.
You know, no, they had to work for it. They had to grind. So it's like, that is why comedy is also a very tight-knit community. It's like, when you reach a certain level in comedy, you've been doing it for a few years, you've traveled a little bit, you've met some people, you realize that the circles of comedy get extremely small. You know, I'm not, like I said before, I'm not famous. I've worked with a lot of famous people. And by virtue of running shows, booking shows, opening for people, touring, doing festivals, I've met a lot of comedians. So it's like, that is one thing I love about comedy, is like, if you do it and you're dedicated to it and you're good, you have to be good enough.
Right.
If you're funny, you can literally get to the point where you can meet and work with some of your heroes.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, you can't play you're not going to be in a band in Memphis that just plays covers.
Right.
And then all of a sudden you're like, oh yeah, man, I was hanging out last night with the dudes from Motley Crue. But you can totally
be a dirt park.
Yeah, exactly. You know what I mean? Whoever it is, you know, it doesn't matter. You know, you're not gonna be a rapper and you're like, yeah, man, last night I was at 21 Savage's house. It was crazy. You know? But you can literally be a comic and find yourself like, oh shit, I'm smoking weed with Eric Andre right now, or you know what I mean? Or like, oh man, like I opened for Colin Jost, you know, who's what at the time was the head writer of Saturday Night Live. He still does Weekend Update, you know. He's a very funny guy, and I opened for him a couple times, and very nice. Like, we went out for drinks after, and like, he's talking about his girlfriend, and like, I'm sitting there, I'm like, man, your fucking girlfriend is Scarlett Johansson. Like, this is weird. You know what I mean? It's just like, it was a very surreal moment. Yeah. It's like, wow. No other thing could I do that where all of a sudden it's like, hey, what are you doing? Oh, man, I'm just kicking it with the guy from Saturday Night Live talking about Scarlett Johansson. You know what I mean? It's like, it's a wild thing. Yeah. And it's like, comedy can give that to you. You know what I mean? It's just, it's fun. Because, again, we're all in the same boat to a certain degree. And a lot of comics, you know, the famous ones, they realize that. They were once you.
Right.
And they realize that maybe, just maybe, one day you could be them.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's like, a lot of them will treat you with respect. Yeah. And then, because they understand, they're like, you're a comic, just like me. We both do the same thing. Different levels, sure. Right. But we're both doing the same thing. So it's like, it's great when you meet a famous comedian or somebody that you really admire, and then they're super nice.
Right.
You know, they're like, hey, do you want to get lunch tomorrow? And you're like, yeah, of course. You know, it's so cool. Yeah, of course. You know, it's just, it's fun. And it's no other form of entertainment that I know of gives you that kind of, like, unfettered access to people that you admire. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's like, it's crazy. Like, there's a few that I've been fortunate enough to hang out with. There's even more that I've just found myself in the same room and, like, I shook hands with them. And that was like, damn. Cool.
I did this.
You know what I mean? Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah, I shook Dave Chappelle's hand after a show one time. And I was like, he was like, hey, what's up, man? I was like, hey, I loved it. He was like, thank you. I was like, thank you. It was cool. And the only reason I was in that position is because I was a comic.
Right.
You know, I didn't get to hang out with him or anything.
Right.
But just being able to meet for a split second, like, to be able to meet him.
It's kind of like a comic-to-comic cool. Comic kind
was
of thing.
Cool. Yeah. You know what I mean? It was just a cool little perk of what we do. Yeah. You know what I mean? Because it's like, that's another thing I tell them in the class, though, which is true. It's like, if you're here to be famous, you can just leave.
Right. Right.
You can just leave because, literally, this shit's like, this is NFL-type numbers.
Right.
Meaning, like, you can be a good comedian, which means maybe you're Tim Tebow in college.
Right.
Oh, you're a damn good college player.
Right.
You know what I mean? Oh, you won the Heisman. You're good. You know what I mean?
Right.
But then you take that next step to the NFL, and you're like, oh, shit, I'm just
I'm
okay.
Whack.
I'm just okay.
Right, right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's literally, you know. Right. So it's like, there's no reason to try to be famous. I mean, I know it's easy to say that. Some people are like, oh man, I want to be famous. I want to be famous. It's not about, you know, it really shouldn't be about that. It should be with comedy. It should be like, I want to be as funny as I can possibly be. And if I'm as funny as I can possibly be, then maybe that will parlay into
right.
something else.
Right.
So the focus should definitely be on the funny. So it's like, if you ever meet anybody, and you know, there's some comics out there, some fake ass comics, that it's like, they talk about themselves, and you can tell, you know, they're like, they're only in this because they're like, oh, I'm gonna be famous. It's like, well, you know, I just think that's silly.
Right. Yeah.
It's a silly thing because, number one, you have zero control about it. And I'm not saying don't grind. I'm not saying don't hustle. Do all those things. But you also have to keep it in perspective.
Right.
Because if you get lost in this whole fucking fame contraption.
Right. It's like being a, I guess you say, like being an actor or mm-hmm. something, you know what I mean? Because it's like, anybody could be like, oh, I'm an actor, you know, mm-hmm. this and that. And then you still, but it's like, oh, you've been working in the same coffee shop for 20
yeah.
years.
Yeah,
you
know? Yeah, yeah.
Just
yeah,
trying to get that break, you know?
Yeah.
But
it's all, man.
Still putting in the grind work to
it's all about
get in there.
It's perspective.
Yeah.
It's all yeah. about perspective. If you keep it in perspective, I mean, that's the thing. It's like, have fun. If you're not having fun doing it, what the fuck are you doing it for?
Right.
You know what I mean? You gotta have at least a little bit of fun.
Right,
you
right.
You know what I mean? It's like, especially if comedy is not, if comedy is your 100% career, and you treat it like a career, that's great, but you still should enjoy it and have some fun. But on the other side, if you got a day job and comedy you love it and you know, but you're performing it at night, you still need to have fun, or otherwise you're literally clocking out of one job and clocking to another.
Right, right. Right.
You know what I mean?
So, and make it like I always tell people too, like, with any hobby, or not say hobby, but well, a hobby that you turn into a passion that you love, you have to find that medium in the middle and be like, hey, okay, if I'm taking this serious enough, I'm going to roll with it.
Yeah.
Like, I'm going to try to make money with it, or do what I can do with it, or whatever. Or I'm just going to like, I'm going to leave it to be a hobby. I'm just going to do my day thing and so on and so forth.
Comedy will tell you. That's the thing is, like, you can do it and do it and do it, and certain opportunities will come your way, and maybe something doesn't. But I know a lot of very successful comedians. Success is a relative term. But I know a lot of successful comedians that support themselves, pay their bills, raise a family, and you've never heard their name. You know what I mean? Yeah, maybe they've never been on TV. Maybe they were on TV once in 2004. You know what I mean? And shit like that. But they're still working. They're working in clubs. They're getting paid. They're headlining places. Your average everyday person will never know who they are. But they're doing it. You know what I mean? And there's fine. There's levels to this shit.
Right.
You know what I mean? And it's like, you can be a level below that. Like, you could just be a guy or a lady that... You're like, I love comedy. I get booked. I get to travel a little bit. But maybe you're not even at that level. Maybe you can't support a family. Maybe it's not your main job.
Right.
Maybe you still have a day job, but you're like, oh, I get weekends off, and every weekend I travel and do this. Right. You know what I mean? So it's like, and you can still get a lot of fulfillment out of that. So it's like, there's by no means necessary. Do you have to be like comedy is an end some game? Like, it's all like, if I'm not famous and I don't have a Ferrari and a mansion and a Netflix special, then this is bullshit.
Right.
I don't want to do it. And I quit. You know what I mean? You have to realize, like, is the juice worth the squeeze? Like, what do you want out of it?
Right.
You know what I mean?
It's work to get this tiny house first.
Yes. Well, it's real. It's very easy to sit here and be like, man, I want to be famous, man. I'm going to be on the Tonight Show. I'm going to have a Netflix special. Shit, they're going to give me a sitcom. You know what I mean? Like, I'm going to, ooh.
Right.
You know, it's very easy to say that.
Right.
And then you're like, oh, man, I've been doing comedy 10 years. I ain't got none of that shit.
Right.
I don't have any of that. Yeah. It's like, what have you done? Well, I've gotten to do this and this. I've had this opportunity, and I get paid to do it. I still have to have a day job. You know, if you can look at yourself in the mirror and go, I still love comedy, it's great, and I don't mind. And if those things happen down the road, hey, that's icing on cake, that's great, but I'm happy where I'm at. I think if you can do that, then you're a success.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
That is success. You know, even if you're an open micer just starting off, and you're like, you know what, I go to the open mic 3-4 times a week, I get up, I'm having so much fun, I really enjoy this, I've made new friends, that's successful.
Right.
And that it's all relative. That you're a success. And if you keep going, then you get to the next tier where you're like, now I'm getting booked, now it's everything.
Right.
But at the end of the day, it's just you and you in the mirror.
Right.
You have to realize, like, I'm enjoying this. This is worth it. What I'm doing is worth it to me.
Right.
You know? And whatever level that comes at, then that's success.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Okay, so I got a two-part question then. Would you say... Who would you say, since you've been doing it for a while now, who is your biggest influence and your biggest inspiration?
Oh, man. My biggest influence? Probably two comedians that I've loved for a long time. One is Dave Chappelle. I love Dave Chappelle. I remember watching his Killing Me Softly, which is in D.C., and it was like, of course, I'd watched comedy before that, but that was the first one that ever, I was like, that was genius. You know what I mean? I loved him so much, he made me laugh. And then, for what it's worth, and I think it was 2004? It was 2003, 2004, at a special in San Francisco. I think it's one of the best comedy specials ever recorded. Like, both those just made me laugh so hard, and it was just like... I want to do that.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, the feeling he gave me, I was like, I want to give that to someone else. Like, it really, I know that sounds like corny, but it's true. Like, I was like, damn. I mean, it made me laugh so much. And I would go out with my friends, and, like, they'd seen it, and we would literally just, like, run the jokes back to each other and still laugh about it. And I was just like, this shit was transcendental to me. I was like, this, you know, and it's just like, I gobbled up everything he had, and like, I love the Chappelle show, and just like, but he was like, he was a big influence, especially when I first started. You know, when I first really started consuming comedy majorly, like, he was a big influence. I wanted, like, he was the one that I was like, I want to do that. You know what I mean? And then as far as, like, I find new influences all the time. Like, I mean, and not all of them are necessarily household names. Like, I'll see comics that are, that I've known for a couple of years that are touring, that are nowhere near that level, but they're so good. They're so funny. And just watch what they do. It's like, oh, man. Like, that makes me want to be better. You know what I mean? And it's like other comedians like Kyle Kinane. I mean, Kinane is a fucking beast. I mean, watching him work is just like a masterclass in comedy. Any comedian, if you hear this, watch Kyle Kinane. Like, I've like seen that man do 3 new hours of material inside of like a week. It's insane. And it's all funny. It's all good. I love John Mulaney. Like, the list goes on and on because there's so many. And it's like, with comedy, like, the longer you do it, the more and more you get into the weeds. Like, people are like, who's your favorite comedian? And you say a name, they're like, I've never heard of them.
Right.
It's like, well, you should.
Right.
You
know, but
you
that, that's you what I think check them out. What makes it great. Because yeah. Like, it makes people be like, well, who
exactly.
Is this
guy? You should check them out. As far as inspiration, I mean, a lot of those guys are inspiration, too. But, I mean, my inspiration, I don't know, really comes from my kids, man. I have 3 kids. I have a 9-year-old daughter, and I have 3-year-old twins. And my 9-year-old loves comedy. She loves that I do comedy. She, you know, she is the class clown. She tells jokes at school. Her favorite comedians are Brian Regan and Jim Gaffigan. You know what I mean? And she runs jokes by me. It's so cute. It cracks me up. And, like, she inspires me because she's like, oh, you know, I love that you do comedy. And, you know, she tells her, you know, friends, and I'm like, don't tell your teachers. And she's like, too late, I already told them. I'm like, don't do that, because then they're going to want to watch me on YouTube, and I don't want that shit to happen. But, you know, I mean, I mean, some of these things sound like cliche, but it's true. Like, yeah, my kids are really my inspiration. I'm extremely lucky in that I have a very good support system. My wife is extremely supportive. I mean, like I said, I'm married. I've been married for 14 years. I have 3 kids. And I have pretty much been on the road every weekend of 2019 so far. So it's like, it's very important to have that support, especially doing what we do, because like we talked about, late nights, traveling here and there, you know, it's like, if I didn't have a wife that supported me, then she would fucking divorce my ass a long time ago, you know. So that's really important to me. I mean, my wife understands this, everything we talk about, same thing. She realizes, like, no, you might not be famous. No, you know, you might not ever hit it big, but she knows that this is what brings me joy, and this is what makes me happy. And she supports that, which is, the at the end of the day, the most important thing, is that she wants me to be happy, you know. So in turn, when I'm not on the road, I try to spend as much time as humanly possible with my wife and kids to enjoy that time with them before I have to leave again, you know. And this is one of those things, like, I want to do comedy forever, but, like, as far as, like, how long are you going to be on the road? How long are you going to do all these things? It's all relative. It just depends.
Right.
I'll do it as long as I want to say physically able, but who, you know, you never know what tomorrow holds, you know? So who knows? But, yeah, I'd say, yeah, that's my inspiration, really. It's, okay. Like, it's just trying to balance everything in my life so I get as much out of everything in my life. You know, it's like, yeah, I put a lot into comedy, but I also have to put a lot in my family, because what I put in my family pays out in bigger dividends than what I put into comedy.
Right.
In a certain way.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Right, because you have love and support and
correct.
The backing
exactly.
For that.
Which literally, which that makes you a better comedian, in my personal opinion.
Right.
You know, and I mean, I'm not saying.
It's like you got something you're working for.
Well, sure. Yeah. And I'm not saying, like, if you're a single comedian and everything like that, like, if you don't have that, I'm not knocking that either. You draw your inspiration or whatever you get from somewhere else. But it's like, I didn't start comedy until I was married and my wife was pregnant with our, you know what I mean? So it's like, You know, that's all I've known as a comedian. I know a lot of other comedians that are great, that are single, but they still have good support systems through their comedy family, through their regular family. Their parents support them, their siblings, whoever it is, you know. It's very important to have those people behind you. And there's always that stereotype that, like, comedians are just these mean, curmudgeonly, like, you know, people are like, oh, you're a comedian? Oh, your childhood must have been fucked up. Yeah. Like, no, I had a great childhood.
Yeah, right?
My childhood was great, dude. Yeah. My parents were married for 50 years. I think happiness is a, you know, some people think, like, comics have to be the tortured artist, the tortured soul. I disagree. I mean, if you can, if that's what you are, and you can parlay that into good comedy, and it helps you, and the audience connects with it, that helps them, that's fantastic too. But you can also do the same thing with just being a happy person. You know what I mean? Like, same energy, just different wavelengths.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Positive.
Yeah, exactly. Precisely.
Okay, so I got two last questions for you.
Okay.
First question is, I noticed that too, like on Instagram, that you're a big Jordan person.
So, yeah, I'm a huge sneakerhead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what is your all-time favorite Jordan?
Oh. As far as, okay, my favorite Jordan style is the Jordan 1. Always will be. Jordan 1 is the classic. You know, first came out in 1985. Changed shoes forever. Not only in the NBA, because before then in the NBA, you had to wear white shoes. You had to wear, you know, there weren't, black shoes were not allowed in the NBA. And then when Jordan came out,
with the white Chucks.
Yes. When Jordan came out with the one in 1985, there was certain problems with the league because of the black and red color scheme and the whole nine yards. So it was like an iconic shoe. I mean, they call it the banned one, you know, because it was banned by the NBA. But, like, the one is just a classic silhouette that can literally go with anything. Not to mention there's hundreds of colorways from Jordan. So it's like you can find a one to go with anything. It's just a dope shoe. It looks good. So that's probably my favorite. Followed by probably the threes and the fours. I really, in my personal opinion, I really only fuck with Jordans 1 through 13. And then 14 through 30 are kind of whack. 31s, 32s, 33s, the newer versions, like 31s are dope. 32s and 33s, not so bad, but like, this shit got wacky. Especially, like, the 14 and the 15... I can, 14, 15, 16, 17, like the last Tinkers, this is getting really in the weeds, like Tinker Hatfield is the most influential shoe designer of all time, and he was the main Jordan designer. He's picked up the Jordan with the Jordan 3, but Tinker also created the Air Max.
Yeah.
Like the Air Max that you think of, like the Air Max 90, you know, or shit like that. That's all Air Max 1, that's all Tinker Hatfield. And, like, Jordan was leaving Nike after the Jordan 2, because the Jordan 2 was kind of a flop, right? So Jordan 2 came out, wasn't super well received, and to this day is actually kind of a cult Jordan. Like, not a lot of people fuck with the 2, because it's a little bit of a bulky silhouette.
Yeah, it's like a giant bubble.
Yeah, it's based on, like, Italian fashion design, whatever. It was like a weird inspiration. But Jordan was going to leave Nike, and Nike asked Tinker, they were like, you gotta save us. You know, you gotta whip something up and show it to Jordan. So Tinker created the 3, and with the Jumpman, you know, all that shit. And then Jordan was like, okay, alright. And stayed. So, I mean, he saved Nike, you know, with that design. And he designed the Jordan all the way up through the 17. And then, but like, 14's okay. 15 is the ugliest fucking shoe.
I'm not even. I don't even fuck with 14.
I don't really like. I don't particularly care for 14s either. 15's a fucking abomination. 16 and 17 are just like the spats, yeah. Shit like that. Ugh. I just. But then 18 to 29 are fucking whack. They're all whack.
Because I think I. Yeah, because I would say. Really, yeah, I guess I would say that too. Yeah, 18 to 29 are all.
30s were okay.
30s were kind of in between. They were like fashion and could be used for basketball.
Yeah, yes.
Because like that, the other ones were just made
the
for
31, 32, and 33 went back to being an actual shoe for balling. Yeah. Like you could ball in those shoes.
Right.
Like you couldn't fucking ball in like a 20.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean? You can't wear that shit on the court. Yeah. But like 31 to 33, they've gone back to like, okay, now we're an engineered basketball shoe. But like for a long time, Jordan was strictly a lifestyle model. You know what I mean? And it's like, yeah, there's, but like one through 13, they're all dope. They're great. I love Jordans, of course. Like I fuck with Jordans heavy, but I like a lot of other Nikes. I fuck with Adidas and other things. I've got about 200 pairs of shoes. I flip them. I buy them. I flip them. I save them. You know, the whole nine yards. So it's just, that's a huge hobby of mine. I have a few things I care about. Comedy, of course. My family, which goes without saying. But I love shoes. I love comic books. And I love Funko Pops. And for a while, I still am. I love hats. I have a ton of fucking New Era 5950s, man. I like a nice fitted flat brim hat. But yeah, man, shoes are a major part of my life. I love shoes. Like it's also like I love them and I wear them all the time. But now I'm known as like a comedian that likes shoes. Yeah. So everywhere I go, people are like, "Oh shit, what kind of kicks you wearing?" Right. Yeah. I'm that guy, you know, that they're like, "Oh shit, what are you wearing?" And it's like it's not uncommon. There's several comedians that are sneakerheads. There's a lot, but like Bert Kreischer's a big sneakerhead. Bert Kreischer is actually a Nike influencer.
Oh,
like he gets the first look shit from Nike. Tom Segura is an influencer for Adidas. And there's several, man. I know I've worked with Donnell Rollins. Donnell Rollins has a lot of flat kicks. Carlos Miller, Clayton English. There's a lot of comedians out there that fuck with shoes. I like shoes. Yeah, I'm like, I've always liked shoes. I've always been a fan. But like when I was a kid, like my parents were like we were middle class. You know, we weren't hurting, but we also weren't rolling in it.
Right.
So it's like I think when I was a kid, I got one pair of Jordans ever. My parents were like, well, too fucking expensive. Why you want a pair? And I had the military blue fours, and I loved them. And after that, my parents, especially as the feet get bigger and you get the men's sizes, my parents are like, you fucking crazy. I'm not buying this shit. I'm rocking British Knights and shit. And, yeah.
Sketches.
And, oh, yeah. Yeah. So I always told myself, I was like, when I'm old and I have some money, I'll buy whatever shoes I want. You know? And it was like, it took me a little while. It was like my 20s and everything like that. But it's like, I have a pretty good day job that's also very flexible. It gives me a lot of time to travel and stuff like that, but I do have a day job. I have to, because I have to support my family. And like I said, like we were talking about earlier, it's very difficult to make enough money to support a family on comedy. Like, you have to survive, right. You know? But it's like, since I have that job, most of my comedy money, whatever I have left over after using it for whatever, it's like, that's kind of, I buy shoes. Right. Like that, because I love them. You know, I love them. But it's also, I've bought shoes and made major money on selling them. Like, man, I've sold it, especially back when Yeezys were real hot. I sold a bunch of Yeezys, made a bunch of money. Paid a lot. Yeah, I sold 3 pairs of Yeezys, made like $1,800 profit.
Nice. Nice.
Yeah, like, shoes are, it's getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Like, shoes is, of course, like a multi-billion dollar industry.
Right.
But now the resale industry and, like, how popular they are and everything like that, that's an industry in and of itself. Exactly. It's crazy. So it's like, if I got all the shoes I tried to get, holy shit.
Right.
But I brick on shoes all the time. Like, I want this pair and I can't get them.
Right.
You know, I'm like, damn it. You know, or I'll find a pair I would never wear, but I know I can make a couple $100 by flipping them.
Right.
You know, shit like that. So it's like, whatever I can get my hands on.
Right.
You know, either for personal or just to be able to try to flip it to make a little bit more money. I kind of treat it like drugs. In that, like, it's like being a dope dealer. It's like, if you've ever sold weed, most people that sold weed sold weed so they can smoke weed for free.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. So it's like I buy shoes and sell shoes so I can buy more shoes.
Right. Right.
That's pretty much what it is. It's the same thing. But yeah, I'm a huge fan. Jays are my absolute favorite. My absolute, I don't know, it might change from day to day, but my absolute favorite Jay of all time is probably the shattered backboard ones. Orange and black.
Okay. Yeah.
Which are about a grand, probably about $1,200. And it's like, I'm in no fucking position to pay.
Yeah.
Like, I could sell some shoes and, like, do that, but then it's like, I would just want to hold them and look at them rather than wear them all
right.
Because they're worth so much.
Right.
But it's like, that's a pair one day I really want to own that pair. You know? It's like me and a couple other comics, and a couple of them have actually already done late night. Used to play this game where we talk about, like, what shoes would you wear if you were on The Tonight Show, if you were on whatever. And it's like, since then, yeah, they have worn J's, even with a suit, wore a suit with J's on their fucking playback sex. They're like, yeah, I want to wear these shoes, you know. It's like, treat yourself.
Right.
You know, I remember when Noah Garden Schwartz did his playback set. He went out and bought the low-top Cherry 11 just to wear. He was, like, on Instagram, like, which pair should I buy to wear? it's a thing. You know? If you like sneakers, you're like, yeah, man, it's, like, a big part of your fit, you know, your outfit. So it's like, yeah, I play that game. I'm like, what shoes should I wear? If I ever get something big, I might have to go buy those shattered backboards just so I can wear them.
We need a special, man.
It's a flex.
Yeah.
Tell the cameraman, be like, make sure you get my shoes in there. Make sure you get
the
shoes.
The full circle around.
Exactly. I mean, there's females too. Michelle Wolf, she's a big sneakerhead.
Yeah.
If you watch her HBO special, she's wearing some custom made Nike, like, dunk wedges. They're gold.
What?
Yeah. If you watch her special on HBO, they're like a custom-made pair of Nike wedges. It's crazy. I like sneakers.
Nice.
I like sneakers.
My last question, I guess I'm going to ask, is with your wilt, I know you're going to do, you're doing like you talked about earlier, doing roast battles on the account, Comedy Central app. So if you had to choose the stage anywhere in America or the world, the stage that you would want to do, say, your giant special on.
Yeah.
And then between, we'll say, Amazon, Netflix, HBO, and Showtime.
Ooh. All right, HBO. Yeah. For sure. Netflix is fantastic. Netflix is great, but there's still a huge prestige factor for doing an HBO special. Because HBO does not give specials out like candy.
Right.
Like, during the first comedy boom, like in the 80s and 90s and shit, if you go back and look, like, HBO was all over comedy. They're airing that shit all the time. But then the comedy bubble busted. And then now they've definitely been more selective. So when you see, there's only, like, maybe 3 to 5 a year they put on there. So, I mean, HBO is, like, still, I think, the most prestigious. Netflix probably pays the most. I mean, I know how much they paid for some of those specials. I mean, it's a lot amount. I mean, I think Amy Schumer for her last special got $14 million or something like that. Chappelle, Rock, $20 million apiece. $20 million per special. And Chappelle released, what, 4 specials, $20 million apiece, $80 million. But I'd probably say, like, your average, like, comedian, like, if you're not Chappelle level, but you're big enough to get an HBO special, you're probably going to make a minimum of $500,000, $750,000, $1 million, something like that. HBO, of course, I can't claim to know how much they pay, but I would imagine probably commensurate with that, you know, close. But it's just something about saying you got an HBO special, you know, so probably HBO. As far as where... That's an interesting question, because I guess it depends on, do you want it small and intimate, or do you want it huge? So I would probably say, like, a mid-sized theater that maybe holds, like, a couple thousand people or something like that. That is, you know, if I'm to the point where I've got that special, I can draw that many people, you know. I'd want to do it in the South, and there's some great theaters in the South. Like, for instance, in Atlanta, there's the Fox. I mean, hell, even the Tabernacle is really cool. Fox with the Tabernacle. Or in Chattanooga, they have a beautiful theater. I've seen Chappelle there. The Tivoli Theater in Chattanooga.
Okay.
It's a beautiful theater. Like, really. But I will go ahead and say, like, those would be great, but now that I think about it, number one, the Ryman Auditorium in Nashville.
Okay.
You know the Ryman?
Yeah.
Which is an old converted church.
Yeah, right.
Beautiful space, which I've seen Chappelle there too. A lot of comedians that record there. Bill Burr recorded a special there. That's just a majestic fucking theater. Old church, stained glass. You sit in pews.
Yeah.
Like it's legit. It's great. Like when I saw Chappelle there. The whole thing with the Ryman, like, you can't, like you would think, like, in any theater, you can't smoke, but it's always been you can't smoke in the Ryman, because it's all wood and everything like that, so they're like, even back in the day when it was acceptable to smoke everywhere, you couldn't smoke in the Ryman. Like, it's a whole legend. They wouldn't let Johnny Cash smoke in the Ryman. That's Johnny Cash.
Right.
In Nashville. Wouldn't let him smoke in the Ryman. So when Chappelle came out at the Ryman, he came out, lit up a cigarette on stage, and said, "This is for Johnny Cash," and puffed on the cigarette, put it on the stage, and put it out with his foot. Which was the most baller shit. I was like, damn! That is just straight baller shit. But that's a beautiful theater, and it's right around in that size, too, like 2,000 to 3,000. Just beautiful, lots of history, and Nashville's a great comedy town, so the Ryman Auditorium. That's okay. What I would do with the Ryman.
Yeah.
The Ryman on HBO.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's it. That's what I would do.
Nice.
Legendary. That should be great.
It would be.
It would be dope. It would be very great. I mean, it's like, again, we talked about the South earlier. It's like, I wanted, like, Bill Burr's recorded a couple things in the South, and a couple other comedians have too, but I mean, I definitely want to see more of, like, the South's a beautiful place. We got a lot of cool shit down here. I definitely like to see the South utilize more in seeing stuff on television. I think that would be great. So definitely, I'd have to stay in the South, support this shit.
Cool. Well, I definitely appreciate you coming on the show, man.
Sure, man.
On the podcast.
Yeah.
So, thanks, Scott, man, for coming out.
All right.
And everything like that, bro.
Do an end drop or whatever. Like where I can say my social media.
I was actually about to
tell you. Are we doing that right now?
Yeah.
I didn't know what you were doing. He's over here pressing buttons and shit. You think I know what's going on? I don't know. But no, thank you for having me on the podcast. But you can find me on all social media at TheScottEason, TheScottEason. That's it, on all social media. Find me on there, and I'm all over the place. I'm not sure. When will this come out?
It'll come out in like a week. Mm-hmm. It'll come out in like almost a week.
Okay. I've got some cool stuff coming up. We'll be on Comedy Central Roast Battle on April 12th, which I'm not sure if you'll hear this by then. But be on the lookout for me on Comedy Central Digital or the Comedy Central Roast Battle podcast, which you can find on pretty much all podcasts and channels. And later this year, we're going to shoot something pretty cool for Amazon called Punching Below the Bible Belt Comedy in the South, which hopefully will be premiering on Amazon sometime next year, 2020, if it gets picked up. So a couple cool things coming up, and hopefully you can see me in a city near you sometime soon. But had a good time. Thank you.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I can't wait to see you. Hope you come back next year.
Of course, I will. Of course. Man, I love Memphis. Memphis is great. So, yeah, fully support everything you guys are doing here. It's awesome.
Definitely. Appreciate it, man.
All right, thanks.
And as always, everybody, you can donate to the show at Cash App at TwoBakeStudios.com. And you know what's up. All right, and we out.